accession number 20062, rail 3.
Brigadier Benz, rail 3.
I was talking about the smoke screen, and we were behind the smoke screen, obviously, a mile or so back from the river, and we were preparing shells and generally getting ready for this battle. And it reminds me of an incident there. Our colonel, by then, we'd got a new colonel, and the colonel's name was Woozy Smith, who I think ended his days as in Bermuda or somewhere, I think. Anyway, he was known as Woozy, and his truck had come in the middle of the night in his caravan to his regimental headquarters, and he'd been in it asleep, and somebody had backed it in the middle of the night into a farmyard, when he woke up in the morning, he got up, went out, without, I suspect he went out to spend a penny or something, hadn't really looked where he was going, got off the end of the truck, and they'd backed it right into an enormous manure heap, and he fell slap into this. And this story went round the regiment, and it was really rather unfair, because he'd only just joined, and everybody thought it was frightfully funny that the colonel had fallen into a manure heap. It was pretty childish, really. Anyway, but there was one thing about which reminds me of something else. Earlier, why had we got a new colonel? We'd had a colonel called Edward Stansfield, who had been with the regiment for years, out in the desert and battling through Sicily and then into Italy, and then come back with the regiment. He was an absolute charming man. Everybody loved him. And when we were coming up from the Seine, in the sort of breakout, towards Beauvais, as usual, there were far too many people trying to get along the road. And we were with 7th Armoured Brigade then. 8th Armoured Brigade, Independent Armoured Brigade. And we were supporting the 4th, 7th, among other regiments. And they got stuck by some anti-tank guns near Beauvais. And the OP officer who was up with them from our regiment called for fire from the guns. Well, we'd been trundling up the road. And, of course, there had been an enormous number of other people trundling up the road. And it was desperately difficult to get off the road quickly and get into action to fire for this call to deal with these German anti-tank guns. And so what the result was that we took a long time to respond. And by chance, a brigadier, a chap called Rawlins, who was the sort of senior gunner for the Corps, and he used to ride a motorbike, which was quite sensible of him because he could really get around and traffic blocks didn't worry him so much, instead of a jeep. And he happened to be there, amazing chance, and he came roaring up in his motorbike. He had a flag, little brigadier's flag on the front bumper, and said, "What the hell's going on?" And discovered that the guns, because of all this traffic on the road, had not been able to respond properly to this call for fire. And he was very angry and sacked the colonel on the spot. And we never actually saw the colonel to say goodbye to him. And that was why we'd got Woozy Smith. I didn't remember that now because, of course, it was surprising. But in those days, if commanders, Monty sacked a number of people in Normandy, divisional commanders, brigade commanders and others, and so it wasn't such an extraordinary thing to happen, which nowadays it would be. And that was the end of Edward Stansfield, which was a great pity. There was another, that reminds me of something else that happened about then. When we crossed the Seine at Vernon,
just before this incident with the colonel at Bebe, the first night after crossing the river, we stopped in a village. I was with an OP party then, and in a half track with a driver and a couple of signalers, and on our own. I say on our own, we were in a column with an armoured regiment, but from the battery point of view, we were entirely on our own, and nobody knew what we were doing, really. And we ended up the night in a farm, and I walked in and chatted to the farmer and his wife, and they said, "Can we give you a bed for the night?" So we said, yes, we thought we'd love a bed for the night. We were slightly concerned because we weren't at all sure whether there were any Germans around still. However, it was pretty clear nothing was going to happen during the night, and everybody had stopped. And we put the half track inside the barn, locked the door, hoped it wouldn't get stolen, hoped no Germans would come, and went back to the farm, and had a very good evening sitting around the table with the farmer and his family. And he had a very pretty daughter who I remember so well singing Chateau André and other French songs. And it was extraordinary. It was the first sort of human connections we'd had since we'd left England, because Normandy, there hadn't really been an opportunity for anything like that. And it brought one back to ordinary existence. It's just something I remember. Anyway, getting back to the chronology a bit, I think we were at the Rhine crossing, and we were in support of the Highland Division, 51st Highland Division, who did an assault crossing of the river, and following the landing by 6th Airborne on the other side at Wesel, and we could see the gliders and coming over and the parachute dropping in front of us, just the other side, very successful drop. And the Highland Division went across in assault boats, and very sadly, there at the crossing, their general, Rennie, was down there encouraging them over and was killed. I think a mortar bomb landed directly on top of him on the riverbank. And that was very sad, because he was a well-known, popular, and a good general. And then we rather dropped out of the war because, as I said earlier, we had belonged really to 50 Div, and they had been disbanded. And although we'd been attached to other divisions throughout the winter, the preceding winter, and in fact taken part in all the major actions that had gone on, once the Rhine was crossed, it was really a race to get to the Baltic and as far as possible before the Russians got there. And as you know, we got up right up to the Baltic, the British across the Elbe and up to the Baltic at Lübeck, near Lübeck. But we weren't in any of that. There was quite enough artillery without us. So we came back and went into Holland and sat for several weeks on the south bank of the Rhine, or the Waal, as they call it, doing very, very little, with supporting a marine brigade who were there, who were doing patrols across the river. And during that time, I went back on my very first leave to England. And when I came back, the regiment had moved again into Germany and were near Emden, where we were supporting the Poles, the Polish Armoured Division, who were attacking northwards up to the North Sea at Emden. And we ended the war there. And so the last few weeks were a little bit of an anticlimax. However, that was, we were all very pleased that the whole thing was over. And within a day or two, we were on the move. And we went, first of all, to an area between Bremen and Hamburg, where we did patrols to try and prevent the displaced persons, mostly Russians, from burning down all the German farms, which they were trying to do, having been slave labor for a number of years, they were pretty anti-German, and they did their best to cause mayhem. And
how did you stop it?
Well, we had armoured car patrols at night. Rather extraordinary. I mean, the war ended, literally just ended, and there we were protecting the Germans from Russians. We tried to make our presence felt, and if we caught people looking suspicious, we grabbed them. And we, in fact, caught some in the act, Russians, and I had to go to court, to a military court run by a British civil administrator, part of the, what it was called, British Military Administration, AMGOD, was it? Allied Military Government of Occupied Territories or something like that. And at Bremervörde, where a couple of Russians we'd grabbed were up in court for setting fire to a farm, and a Russian officer, the first one I'd ever seen, came over to defend them. And in the end, the court released them into his care, which was probably a disaster for them, because I think most of the Russians who had been working in the West as slave labor were, as soon as they got back to Russia, they were whisked off to Siberia or somewhere into the Gulag as being unreliable, having been exposed to Western influences. So it had probably been better off if they'd gone to a prison in West Germany. But that wasn't the form. And then we went to Hamburg. We're now talking about, I don't know, fortnight after the war ended, perhaps 3 weeks. And we went to Hamburg where, because I could speak German, I was removed from my regiment and sent to the local army headquarters, where we lived in great style in the most wonderful hotel called the Ferjaritzaten, the Four Seasons on the Alster in Hamburg, on the Binnen Alster, with our offices next door in the Shell building, and all the hotel staff. That bit of Hamburg, the sort of rich bit, had hardly been damaged in the war all around the Alster. The docks had been destroyed, and all the working class suburbs had been destroyed along the river, but that particular part of Hamburg was almost intact. And I was there throughout the whole of that summer. I don't know, would it be interesting to mention one or two things there?
Please.
This is
please.
After the war ended.
Please.
Well, I can't remember a lot. I remember Zhukov coming over, the Russian general, and having to work out a program for him, which was interesting. I also remember Montgomery had set himself up in a schloss further south near Bad Oeynhausen, and the schloss had a moat, and he wanted swans in his moat, and he wanted black swans in his moat. So we got an order telling us to requisition some black swans from the Hagenbeck Zoo in Hamburg, and I was told off, because I could speak the language, so to go and organize this. And I went to the zoo and found half a dozen likely-looking swans and said, right, we'll have those. And the zoo crated them up. And then was the question of how do we get them down to Monty? And he sent up his aeroplane, which was not a very big one. I can't remember, I think it was probably a Dakota or an Anson. Anyway, the crates wouldn't go in the door. So in the end, they sent a bomber up, a Liberator, enormous great aeroplane, and we loaded these crates of swans into the bomb bays from underneath. I remember thinking that was rather extraordinary, really. There was a large aeroplane being used to cart some swans about 200 miles for the commander-in-chief. Anyway, I remember that.
What impression did Zhukov make?
I don't think he made any impression on me at all. All I did was to work out when he was coming, where he was going, how long for, and how long it would take, and how did we guard him. We weren't quite sure what the Germans would make of it. I don't think I was thinking particularly that hard at that time. I was thinking about, and most young men think about girls at that time, and I was too, because we had this non-fraternization rule, and you weren't meant to talk to Germans. Well, normally speaking, in the countryside, of course, you could ignore it. But when you were in the town and part of the headquarters, you couldn't ignore it quite so easily. But I got myself involved with the intelligence world. And they were a law unto themselves. And they took absolutely no notice of this, because they said, well, unless we speak to all the Germans, how do we get any intelligence? So their headquarters and messes were full of the most gorgeous German girls. I remember that very well. And the other thing I did, and this was just before I joined the headquarters, we used to have to try and find Nazis. And the regiments in Hamburg were given an area, a sector of the city, and had to do night searches of houses. And we were given an interpreter, a local chap who I think had worked for the police. And he was meant to tell us where he thought a family were Nazi sympathizers. And we'd then go to the house, turn it upside down, look for Nazi literature and that sort of thing. And if there was any, cart the householder off to jail, where he would be tried. And would be investigated. And I'm absolutely sure this interpreter was merely paying off old scores. I think it was really not a very gentlemanly way to go on. While I was at the headquarters, I was sent up to the German army, which was most of it in Schleswig-Holstein. As the Russians had pushed east and we'd pushed from the west and south, the German army had sort of been squeezed up into Schleswig-Holstein, where a lot of it was sitting in makeshift camps and fields and barns and houses and so on, waiting to be demobilized. And while it was there, the idea was that we should find anybody in the SS, officers in the SS, go and collect them and cart them off to a concentration camp just outside Hamburg called Neuengamme, where they would remain until they came up in front of a war crimes tribunal. And that was interesting too, because I imagine the courts used what evidence they could, but clearly it was extremely difficult to know whether somebody had been in the SS or not, because they would remove their SS insignia. However, I suppose a number of them were caught, and I suppose you had to do something about it. Anyway, that's all I can remember of them. And then we come to a time when I went to Palestine, which that August, after I'd had a very happy, May, June, July, August, 4 months in Hamburg, and very interesting and most enjoyable, and living in great comfort, my regiment, which I was still in, although detached, was suddenly warned that it had got to provide people who were regulars to join a force which was going to invade Japan. The 3rd British Division was reconstituted with people who were either regulars or had a reasonable length of time still to serve, because the army was starting to demobilize and getting people out. And we formed up outside Brussels, and we were going to join over in the States. We were going to Kentucky, and there we were joining an American corps which was going to form part of the force to do a land invasion of Japan the following spring. And I joined 6th Field Regiment, which was one of the 3 field regiments, 25 pounder regiments in 3 different. And we were sitting outside Brussels from, I suppose, August through to October, I think. And of course, we never got to Kentucky, rather sadly. I mean, although it was a good thing, I suppose, that we might have invaded Japan and probably all been killed, because I think the Japs would have fought like hell. But the atom bomb was dropped, and so instead of going to Japan, we went down by train to Toulon, a place called Hyères, and were put on a troop ship to go out to the Middle East. and the whole division ended up in Egypt in the early winter of 45. And then I had my time in Palestine. Would you like me to go straight on with that?
Yes, please.
We went by train down, it was called the Medlock route, which had been set up in conjunction. Troop ships went backwards and forwards from India or Egypt to Toulon. And then there was an enormous transit camp at a place called Yerre, just along the coast from Toulon. Everybody going out to the Middle East or the Far East and back again, unless the ship by any chance went all the way back to England, which some did, transferred to trains and then trundled up to France and then over to England or wherever. Anyway, we got down there and we went over to Egypt in a New Zealand ship. Whose name I'm not going to remember. It was the Rangitoa or Ranga something like that. And got to Port Said, where we were put in a train of cattle trucks and went down to a hideous spot in the middle of the desert outside, sort of inland from the Suez Canal, called Kassassine, where, thank God, we only stayed for a few days because it really was just bare tents on bare sand and a fearful shock after the comforts of Hamburg. And then I was then regimental survey officer, I think. And we then went to Geneva, and then we went up to a camp near Haifa. And we drove there through the desert, having got all our guns and equipment together. We drove across the Sinai and up through Palestine and up the coast to somewhere between Haifa and Athlete in olive groves just below Mount Carmel, where we started learning about internal security, as it was, to deal with the Jewish threat that we'd got at that stage when we were, the whole problem of the Jews wanting to come in great numbers into Palestine to start establishing themselves as they'd been promised in the agreement, the Balfour Declaration after the First World War, or in the First World War. And of course the Arab view exactly the opposite, who were living there, and that it was their country and why the hell should all these Jews come in? And as usual, we were caught in the middle. Mainly through our own fault in promising the same thing to two people. But we had a very pleasant little tented camp, but partly hutted, partly tented. And to begin with, didn't do much at all, patrolling. And I, at that stage, became adjutant of my regiment. I had a very nice colonel called Tiddler Wilson, who was an ex-airborne gunner. And we had a pleasant time playing football and rugger against other regiments and enjoying ourselves in the sort of night spots of Haifa. And the local hospital, British Military Hospital, in Haifa, where lots of nice girls as nursing sisters in the Queen Alexandra's nursing service provided our girlfriends. And we used to go for picnics up at Capernaum on Lake Galilee, where there was really no development in those days. I'm now talking about 45, 46. And I remember driving across the mountains or the ridge of Palestine to Bethlehem on Christmas Eve and getting there in time for midnight to a service in the Church of the Nativity. That was something that stuck in my mind because the High Commissioner came, whose name I can't remember, and the British High Commissioner, and as a result of the threat from the Jews, there were armed sentries all around, I think it's called Manger Square, the square outside the Church of the Nativity. I remember that, and sort of floodlights and things. We then ducked around in Palestine quite a lot. We kept changing places. We used to shuttle. There were three divisions involved. There was 6th Airborne, and there was 1st Infantry Division and 3rd Infantry Division. We were in 3rd. And generally speaking, we'd spend a number of months in Palestine. Then we go back down to the Canal Zone to a place called El Bala, which is halfway down the canal between Port Said and Ismailia. And it was sort of peacetime soldiering at one end, with lots of sport and a bit of training and not much else. And at the other end, a sort of semi-operational terrorist, counter-terrorism. And you went from one to the other. And in Palestine, I suppose the most interesting place we went to was Latrun, for one of our sessions up there. We were still managing to go off and shoot duck at weekends up at Lake Huli, which is north of Lake Galilee, and we had some ponies. And just next to us at Latrun was a monastery, a Trappist monastery, where the monks made very good brandy and white wine, which they call Chablis, and cheese, and we made friends with them as much as you could, because being Trappists, they weren't allowed to talk. And we were living in a police fort. There had been a number of, I think they were called Tegut forts. They were sort of square, concrete, large-ish forts, probably held a couple of hundred people, spread across the country, which had been put up when the Arabs had been causing havoc, pre-war days. And now they were used as police posts for the Palestine police. And we shared one of these with the Palestine police. And that was our regimental headquarters, where I was living. And then down below us, this was on the very edge of the hills, as the hills that run up to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, the road goes into the hills. And this fort and Latrun was just at the bottom of the foothills. And down on the plain below us, there were a couple of prison camps which had got Jewish terrorists in them who'd been caught here and there. And interesting aspect of our life there was that we had a large number of Danes. We had something like 100 Danish soldiers in the regiment. And I investigated this the other day, as to why this was, and I'm not absolutely sure of my facts, but as I understand it, at the end of the war, the Danish government and the king, I think in particular, felt that they owed us a favour in that we had liberated Denmark, that we'd gone on fighting the Germans, who they hated. They had suffered under the Germans, but hadn't done much about it. Or not that they could have done much about it. And they therefore said that they would allow the British to recruit in Denmark. And Danish young men who'd been cooped up were all desperate to get around the world. And here was a chance of a free trip paid to see the world. And so they came in fairly large numbers into the British Army. And a lot of them ended up as gunners. And they were bright young mostly blonde boys of about 20. And although they'd been cooped up under the Germans, they must have fed fairly well, because they all seemed extremely fit and healthy and far better in physically than our soldiers. And the other thing was, of course, that they were keen young men, whereas our soldiers who'd been in the war, all they wanted was to get out. 90% of them. And